Emotional Fornication. The second talk in a series titled Sodom and Sexual Purity was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 14, 2003, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
I was at the age that most of you are at when I was back in the 60s, at a very different time in American culture, and a very different time in terms of culture, of sexual attitudes. So my ideas were formed in another time and place. I think they're still very, very relevant today, but they're not nearly as pointed toward your culture as they were toward mine, and hopefully that'll become clear. Part of the mythology that I've already talked about in past lectures that we've inherited is that sex is evil and bad, or at least potentially evil and bad, if not out and out evil and bad. Love, on the other hand, is never anything but good and right and noble. I mean, that message just comes at us in many, many, many different ways in our culture. I mean, all the movies, love is what makes the world go round, love is what will save the world, love is what will save your life. Love is just everything. And it can never be bad, it can only be good. That's part of the mythology that drives our attitudes and has for a long time in our culture. One of the bad consequences of that, one of the things that proves to be misleading about that, is we recognize, especially in Christian culture, we recognize that we need to learn self-restraint and self-control when it comes to fulfilling our physical sexual desires. But it never occurs to us that we would ever have to exercise restraint and self-control when it comes to fulfilling our desires for love and emotional satisfaction and comfort. I mean, why would you have to exercise self-control there? Love is love, and love is beautiful, and love is good. That's where I have coined the term emotional fornication, to describe that lack of self-control, that lack of restraint, that kind of emotional promiscuity that is not physically promiscuous, but it is emotionally promiscuous. And that's the topic tonight. I think this applies in two different contexts. My ideas were first formed in the context of single people relating to one another, and that's why I called it emotional fornication. But I've come to realize over the years that it's also important in the context of marriage as well. There's a kind of an emotional adultery that can happen. I was pleasantly surprised, probably about a decade or 15 years ago now, there came out an article in the Atlantic Monthly where this woman was describing her horror at discovering her adulterous attachment to another person in the office that involved no sexuality, no physical intimacy at all. It was strictly emotional. But as she reflected on her experience, she came to realize that it was nonetheless a sort of adulterous relationship. What she was describing is what we want to talk about today. And I should add, the logic of my position would carry me to the conclusion, and I think I have seen this as well, that there's a sort of emotional homosexual relationship that's possible as well. This doesn't just have to be between members of the opposite sex. So let me define then what I mean. I think emotional fornication is having the kind and the degree of emotional commitment to and dependency upon another person that corresponds to the kind and the degree of emotional commitment and dependency that one is committed to in marriage, and that one would expect in marriage. In other words, it's the marriage relationship mapped onto a non-marital relationship at the emotional and psychological level. That's fundamentally what I mean by that. Now, remembering how we defined marriage last quarter, Marriage is a commitment to make another person, that man or that woman, an absolutely unique person in my life. They are special to me. There is no other human relationship that is as special to me as that relationship. I am loyal to them above any other human loyalty. That the unique loyalty, the unique specialness of that relationship is part and parcel of what the marriage commitment is all about. And then marriage is two people becoming one flesh. And the most important respect in which we become one is at the emotional and psychological and interpersonal level. My wife's perception of the world is to be my perception of the world. I mean, that's how intimate the marriage relationship should be. That's what I'm committing myself to. I'm trying to become a student of my wife and learn to see the world the way she sees the world, respect it, identify with it, understand it, and accept it. But that's an incredible level of intimacy, of interpersonal intimacy. It would be very possible to try to mimic that, to try to mimic that level of intimacy and try to mimic that level of specialness at the psychological and emotional level, all the time feeling restrained sexually and physically. Now, that was especially true back in the early 60s, because in the Christian culture of the early 60s, we understood very clearly, much more clearly than your generation does, I think, that sexual intimacy was just flat out wrong. You don't do that and be a godly person. But while we understood that, we played around emotionally. We would do everything in the relationship between a man and a woman except the sex part, but we would try to wear the commitment of marriage or pretend like we were married or act toward one another as if we were married without the sex. And it became a real problem, a real, I think, destructive force in interpersonal relationships. You all tend to have the problem of having both problems. I mean, I don't know that you're better off than we are, but we were forced to a kind of intensity of playing at marriage because sex was off limits in the Christian culture, and we knew that. Now, having said that, I don't want to be misunderstood here, so we mustn't confuse emotional fornication, as I've defined it, with friendship. Those are different. And we shouldn't confuse it with infatuation. That's a different issue as well. Friendship can involve significant level of loyalty and a significant commitment. I understand that. Some of us have deeper and more profound friendship relationships than others. Others of us just aren't wired for it, and it just doesn't happen, and we don't meet that soulmate or that person that we have that kind of rapport with. But some of you are wired for that, and God puts you in a special relationship with another human being that's a very dear and treasured friendship. That's fine. That's not what I'm talking about. There are four ways that I would distinguish emotional fornication from friendship. And I'm going to hearken back to marriage in each of these. Marriage is exclusive by its very nature, by its very definition. Friendship, by its very nature, is non-exclusive. That is true friendship. A friend does not mind being one of a number of friends. That's okay. It doesn't spoil the friendship. It's not a threat to the friendship to have the one that I am a friend to also have other friends. A spouse, on the other hand, rightly wants to be the most special, unique person. That's a God-given desire that is met by marriage. It's not inappropriate, it's appropriate to want that kind of exclusivity. I want to be the only spouse in my wife's life, and she wants to be the only wife for me. Emotional fornication or emotional adultery mimics marriage rather than friendship. In that it expects, it justifies, it rationalizes, and gravitates toward that kind of sense of exclusiveness in the relationship. So emotional fornication justifies feelings of jealousy toward the one I love. It feels justified in feeling that I have a claim on that other person. When I begin making a claim on someone who's not my spouse, or feeling jealous when they have relationships with other people, there's something other than friendship happening there. There's this thing I'm calling emotional fornication. Second distinction, I think, is that friendship does not rightly expect any commitment from the other. If it happens naturally, organically, spontaneously. But in the context of marriage, marriage does rightly expect commitment from the other person, from the marriage partner. It's a duty, it's a moral obligation of the two to one another. Again, emotional adultery and fornication tend to mimic marriage in that regard and have these expectations toward the other person. There is no promise, but there is the expectation in the relationship. Friendship, the third difference, friendship can operate really at any level of trust and intimacy. You can have friends, and even deeper friends, and deeper friends, a deeper level of trust, and friendship works at all those levels. Marriage, by its very nature, is seeking a commitment to complete trust, complete openness, complete intimacy, what the Bible calls oneness. And I'm obligated to that. I don't have a choice about that. I'm really obligated to that. That's what I've promised my wife. Again, emotional fornication or adultery mimics that kind of gravitating toward profound transparency, profound openness, profound trust, whether or not the friendship can bear that or not. And then finally, friendship does not make one's friend the most important person in my life, necessarily. Doesn't need to. But marriage does, and marriage should. Emotional fornication is when I'm making someone that is not my spouse the most important person in my life. So that, hopefully, helps clarify the difference between friendship and what I'm calling emotional fornication. What about infatuation? Infatuation can involve deep and compelling emotions, and those are the emotions that lead us to and seduce us into emotional fornication. Infatuation is usually the ground out of which it comes. But there's nonetheless an important distinction between the two. Infatuation involves the compelling emotions, but it doesn't involve the unjustified expectations toward the other person. I may feel deeply, deeply in love with somebody, but I know that there's no commitment. I know that I have no basis to expect anything from them whatsoever, because there is no promise, there is no marriage, there is no relationship where we have pledged ourselves to one another. So however I might feel, I don't adopt the attitude of expectations. So I don't justify feelings of jealousy. I might be tempted to be jealous, but I have a basis from which I stop myself. And I say, you have no rights here. They are not cheating on you. They are not betraying you. They have made no promise to you. So I don't feel justified in making a claim on the other person's life. And then the other big difference is that infatuation doesn't act on the basis of those feelings of being in love. We talked about this a little bit last week, the importance of not acting on them if those feelings are the sole basis for acting. I may very well act in a manner in keeping with those desires on some other basis. I may be acting like I want to act, but I have other reasons why I do so. But it's wrong, it's inappropriate to simply act act towards someone the way I want to act toward them because I'm in love with them. So infatuation by itself will not do that. Emotional fornication is going the next step and beginning to act on those feelings of love. So infatuation doesn't necessarily seek to create intimacy through what I say and what I do in relationship to the other person. That's where I've stepped over the line and have begun to commit what I'm calling emotional fornication. Because I think it's easier to see in the context of adultery, let's say that I'm married, what would be the symptoms of emotional adultery, of an inappropriate relationship toward, in my case, another woman? If I seek a connection with that other woman more than I seek a connection with my wife, then something's wrong. I've crossed some boundary. If I'd rather talk and spend time with that other person than my wife, then something's wrong. Now, we need to be careful there when we apply this, because obviously when there's stress in the marriage relationship, almost anybody is more interesting to be around than my wife. But that's not what I'm talking about. You know, I'm not talking about because the stress and the tension and the difficulty of the relationship makes it easier to be with other people. I mean, when I really want to be with that other person more than I want to be with my wife, more than I want to be reconciled with my wife, then I've crossed some boundary, I think. If I have a greater concern for the well-being of that other woman than the well-being of my wife, I think I've crossed a boundary. If I tell myself that I married the wrong person, I should have married this woman, then I think I've crossed a boundary. Now, that may sound a little bit strange, and let me explain that for a second. Part of the reason we tell ourselves that is because we have grown up in a culture that has bought into the myth, would love to believe that it's true, that there's this right woman out there for me, or this right man out there for me. And that if I could only find the right woman or the right man, then I will be, like Cinderella, happy ever after. I mean, that's simply a message we get sent all the time. But from a biblical perspective, that's not right. Marriage, as we discussed last quarter, is not about my happiness primarily. It is a wonderful institution. It offers wonderful rewards and wonderful satisfaction. I wouldn't trade marriage for anything in my life. I think it's a wonderful experience on the one hand. But it's not salvation itself, and it's not the fulfillment of my existence, nor should it be. And marriage plays a lot of different roles in our lives as the author of our existence takes us into marriage for his purposes. And if a marriage is going to be a hard marriage, then it's going to be a hard marriage. But it doesn't destroy my existence. And so the attitude that we who are tutored by the scriptures, by the Bible, the attitude that we have to take, that we really need to take toward our marriage is, if this is the one I am committed to, then this is the right woman, or this is the right man. We just shouldn't even allow ourselves to think in terms of, is this the right person? If the certificate says you're married to her, then she's the right person. And that attitude is a very, very important foundation for psychological and emotional foundation for how we relate to one another in marriage and how we avoid emotional fornication. If I feel guilt or shame or a need to hide or conceal or lie about my relationship with the other woman, then I've probably stepped over a boundary. If I am talking and thinking about the other woman all the time, I've probably stepped over a boundary. So those are the kinds of symptoms that I'm talking about that betray what I'm calling emotional fornication. What if I'm already emotionally entangled in such a relationship? I think the response I need to make, out of a desire to do what is right and in good, I should try to disentangle myself, wean myself off that emotional attachment. It's the right and good thing to do. How do I avoid emotional fornication and adultery? Out of a desire to do what's right and good, I should never give myself permission to emotionally attach in an inappropriate way. The problem is we feel the tug, we feel the desire, we feel the temptation, and we don't have any restraint. We don't stop ourselves and say, no, that would be wrong. I can't go there. We let ourselves go there, and we feed and nurture that attachment. We shouldn't feed it. And if that means, practically speaking, limiting personal contact with the person that I'm tempted by, then that's what I should do. I think something like that is the kind of thing Jesus had in mind when he said, I offend you, pluck it out. We need to be serious in our pursuit of righteousness such that we take the measures we need to take to protect ourselves from our own sin, from our own unrighteousness. Well, that should get us started. Nancy and Andrew are going to...
It seemed like the whole issue of exclusivity was sort of paramount to what you were saying. in terms of, it's not a marriage, but it kind of is. We'll kind of act like it, but we know it's not, but we hope it will be. And it seems like you can do that covertly. You can do it without talking about it. You can do it body language. I think we can communicate commitment in a myriad of ways. I mean, time spent together, you don't even have to have deep conversations, certain body language, certain choices we make to spend time with people communicates a certain level of expectation, commitment, and therefore exclusivity. I was just laughing, thinking about... I took the overt route with Emily, and I just was remembering this conversation when we knew we were kind of interested in each other, and we went out to the Rose Garden and on campus, and I said, okay, we can have a relationship, but it's on this basis. And I went through all these rules, you know, we can't do this, we can't do this, we can't do this. And for those of you that know Emily, she looked at me and she was like, that doesn't even sound fun. I mean, she was just like, why would I, what's the point? But I think I wanted to have a certain view of myself as having been to get, have it together, a certain religious exterior. But I wanted that commitment so deeply. And in preparation for this, a lot of my thoughts were what drove me, and I think what drives a lot of people toward the emotional fornication. And I think two things came to my mind were maturity and, the first thing is maturity, I think, is that as we get older, we gain more objectivity on our feelings, on our experiences. We gain more experience, and therefore, through experience, we gain greater understanding of reality, and we're able to make better decisions. I know that was true for me and a lot of people I've spoken with. And the second thing, and this is huge, is I do a public school education program where we talk about sexual abstinence, and I think this is what I see driving so many students, and it just drove me completely in high school and college, was not really knowing myself and looking for exterior things, whether it was sports or whatever. Well, along those lines, what better thing than a relationship to fulfill these needs? And so I wanted that from Emily. Come on, come meet these needs of mine. But I'm not really going to be overt about it. And so I wanted sort of the benefits of this relationship, this exclusivity. And it wasn't, the bottom line, I guess, is what I'm trying to get to is, it wasn't fair to her and it wasn't fair to me. I mean, it wasn't a kind thing to do. Her response to me strikes me now as being so honest. That's not even fun, and it's not. It wasn't. We should have never done that in the first place. We should have done it very differently. I know we'll get into that next week, but I guess, yeah. It just seems like so much of this. We're driven by these emotions, these strong feelings. We want exclusivity. We want something sure. And I think the bottom line is that's so much a part of our rebellion. It's so much a part of not being content with what God's given us, who He's made us to be. And I was thinking about what is purity in this case. And I kind of was like, I think purity is trusting God for the reality that He's given us, whether we like it or not. And I wish I would have had eyes to see that when I was younger. So it's kind of, it's a hard thing to say to someone who, if I were talking to someone who is 16, it's hard to say that. It's kind of like, you just got to believe me, guys. You just got to trust me that this is not a good idea. I mean, that's kind of how I feel. And I remember before, well, Emily and I were dating and hearing some of your ideas about dating. And at the time, not really knowing it because we hadn't experienced it yet. We hadn't gone through it. But taking your word for it. And just going, I think Jack's right. Or I remember David saying some things too. And just taking your word for it. And it really made a big impact. And later experientially learned you were right. You know. But in the meantime, it doesn't feel normal. It's like, no, we really want to do so, you know. And you were right. Again. So, yeah.
Can I just comment on that? That's a good point. I mean, it does take an... Yeah. No. It does take maturity to understand this, and it's true that when we are younger, we're not as mature. But I think the thing that I think we should do in the Christian culture and in the Christian community is, as much as it may not be clear why it's that way, we just need every voice in our community at least laying this out there, is that this is normative, this is normal, this is how it should be, so that more people will just take older people and more experienced people at their word for it. We don't even have that very much. I mean, maybe more of that's going on today than when I was in college, but I don't even think we have very much of that.
Yeah, and I think that my thoughts have been going similarly toward how difficult the task is that you're presenting. I think that we as a culture and humans in general don't respond well to needs that go unmet. And I think it's really part of what is at issue here is, what do I do with this huge need I feel for attaching to another person? Inside a marriage, the same thing can happen, where if my needs aren't being met in my marriage, there's a huge drive to find a place where those needs can be met. And I think that's something that opens up the vulnerability for emotional adultery, for example. But as people who are unmarried, I think the pressure is equally strong to find somewhere to put this huge need that I feel, to find someone to connect with, the thought of sitting still with that is just beyond us. And I think that's part of the really high bar of self-control that we just don't even really talk about. I mean, it's one thing to control our bodies. We talk about, you know, trying to be self-controlled in terms of our sexuality, those kinds of things. But I think there's also this level of self-control that is really critical and very difficult for us, and that is to sit with really big needs that are really uncomfortable and to decide what's appropriate to do with that, rather than immediately putting them onto another person or attaching in a way that meets some of that. So I guess some of the words I use for these ideas are kind of the idea of how is it that I can be responsible with my own needs? How is it that I can be loving in the face of tremendous need on my own part? And I think that's a really good question to ask in the midst of struggling with where do I go with this friendship? What are we doing here? What do I want? When those lines become blurry, the lines that you identified that alert us to maybe something else is going on here, how do I act in the best interest of this other person? I think something that's important to keep in mind is that doing the right thing is loving. So if we talk about being in love or trying to love someone or find out what it means to love, what it comes back to is, and this is what's going to bear out in marriage as well, I mean, what you're going to need to learn as a married person is, how do I love this person? And that's a lot of times going to be, how do I work with my own needs and act in this other person's best interest in the face of that? That is such a principle that is going to follow throughout life, and inside of marriage, it's a huge thing. So I try to encourage unmarried people to really think in those terms, that I'm learning how to be loving before marriage by really trying to take into account what's in the other person's best interest and what is by definition then in my best interest, because that's what's loving. And love works both ways. It's really what's best for me too. So loving is really hard. Acting in someone else's best interest at a cost to me is a really big deal, and we don't do it well. So that's kind of where I go with this. And I think it's really too bad that we don't have a way to work with our feelings somehow. It's kind of what I've been coming back to in my own thinking about this, is that we don't talk a lot about how to process our feelings, how to interpret our feelings, how to understand what our emotions, what our needs are, what that means. Like Jack mentioned last week, when we kind of live in this state of, or the background culture anyway, is one of denial in a way, that if you just repress those needs, if you just pretend they aren't there, that that's the way to go. And I think that's so hurtful, because for one thing, it's not honest, and for another thing, it doesn't really work. They're going to leak out. And so the more I think we can work with understanding who we are and what we bring and how we process things, the better equipped we'll be. Like you were saying about how I find out who I am and how I get to know about myself is a really big part of how I'm going to end up learning how to be responsible and how to be loving to another person. Does that make sense? Let's see if I had any other... Oh, another piece of that, I think, is that we kind of have this idea, maybe less in our community than in some, but I think we're human, and so we have this idea that how in the world could God ask me to go without that thing that I experience as being the very breath that I need to breathe? And that's a really big question that I think we need to ask too, is what is God asking of us, and what does it mean to trust God with what he's given us or not given us? And that applies in a lot of different areas, but I think in this one in particular, because it's such a huge piece of our humanness, that this is, it's a need that we're created with, that's given to us, that's appropriately met on some level in marriage. Like Jack's been saying, I don't think marriage cannot fulfill us, because that's not its purpose. But there are needs, legitimate human needs, that are met in marriage. And to be asked to go without those is a really big deal. And I think it's true that God is within his rights to give us needs that he never intends to meet, because there's something bigger at stake from his perspective, and that is our faith. So that's, I think, part of what we're up against as we try to apply what you're saying.
Can I jump in real quick? Mm-hmm. That helped me fill out the bigger... I hadn't thought about it in those terms, in terms of getting certain needs unmet. I mean, I'm thinking, okay, I'm married, but I still... It's like need for shelter. I mean, or need for... job security, or need, I mean, as life goes on, it's one thing after another of, I want this so much, and God's going, yeah, but what if I don't give it to you? And then in a spouse, even in the person, like you said, Jack, they're not going to meet your needs. They're not going to... I would love to have a spouse that loved the outdoors and loved to go do things I did, Emily pretended she did. We did these hikes, and she was a real trooper. But she doesn't anymore. But it's one of those things where it's like, okay, wow, we're really different, you know? But we were that different the whole time, and so my needs, I could say my needs aren't met, but it's like, tough, you know? She's a great person, and I... enjoy getting to know her for who she is, not who I wish she would be, you know, to meet my needs. Yeah. And I've had, but that's between me and God. And that's been, you know, that's been a difficult but good wrestling match. I mean, it's one among many needs, you know, that we want.
You laid out rules so hikes were the only thing you could do together.
That's true. That's true.
She had to pretend.
Yeah.
That was the only fun thing on the list.
That was it. We can hike, but no holding hands. Yeah.
I think that's a great fill-in. It seems that the idea that marriage is about taking on this life project of getting to know this other person, mm-hmm. is, I think, a great mm-hmm. frame for that. It's not about me getting all my needs met. Mm-hmm. It's about me exploring this other person and myself in the reflection of that person. Mm-hmm. So.
Archaeology of the spouse.
Archaeology.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me illustrate one of the things that Nancy was saying. Not too long before Jody and I got engaged, I was working fairly closely with several other women in a kind of a ministry. And one of them I knew pretty well. We were good friends. And one day we were alone, and she started asking me some questions about marriage, what I expected from marriage, what I wanted from marriage, children, that kind of stuff. I probably knew better, but I went for it, and I talked. And I was fairly self-revealing about what made me tick and what I wanted and what I was thinking about. And when I got engaged to Jody, this woman was devastated. And I was in large part to blame, I think. Because as I look back, the nature of the way that I approached the relationship, I think I was too open. I think I was too intimate with her. And I raised expectations. Now, I could put it onto her. You know, I could say it's your fault, you know, you. But I have to admit, looking back on it, I sure didn't do anything to help her. And I should have been more loving. I should have been kinder. The right thing for me to do would be to be alert to the potential message that I was sending to her and realize I was in no position to send that message, that I didn't know what I wanted at that point. I didn't know where my life was going to go at that point. And so when I saw the emotional devastation in her life, I saw the results of my lack of love. And I think it was exactly revolving around these issues. Shall we open it up?
Hey. I remember going to a marriage seminar when we were engaged. And, you know, pretty typical Christian view of what marriage looks like that was presented. And I think they took the verse out of Revelation where, you know, the image of Christ is chastising some church for losing sight of their first love. And so they have this view of marriage that, you know, you're giving your love to somebody, but you better not forget your first love. So you have to somehow cram God inside that relationship and kind of, you know, maintain your obligations to both. And, you know, so there's this sort of
love triangle
that gets instituted where it's like you and your spouse and God, and you know, as you move closer to God, you get closer together. Mm-hmm. So I guess would you characterize that sort of view of marriage as being similar to this, where in a sense, you know, you're if the expectation of what the relationship that you have with God is that it ought to look like a marriage, in that, you know, you're always, you know, unburdening yourself to God and you know, fixating your emotions upon God and doing all this and all that and, you know, that sort of thing. I could see how that could very much be like what you're talking about. Emotional fornication. You're doing it with a deity.
Emotional fornication with God.
Right. So, I mean, are we talking about totally different categories here, or do you think that there's a parallel?
Wow. I wasn't ready for that question. Let's see.
So are you saying that there could be a way that we think about a relationship with God that is supposed to meet all of our needs? Is that in part
right.
what you're...
I am married to somebody who, say, is very difficult to get to know emotionally. They are just guarded. And so instead, I project all of my emotions at God. And
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I need to think about that for a second, but I think you're right. Now, a legitimate relationship with God, of course, you can't be too intimate, you can't be too obedient, you can't be too dependent. I mean, a legitimate relationship.
That's a different expectation.
Yeah, because a legitimate relationship with God would, like Nancy's saying, drive you to go back and do the hard work in the marriage relationship that you really need to do to make that commitment to do what God has asked you to do. I mean, that's to love God truly, is to do that by loving your wife or loving your husband. It is true. I have seen relationships where not the real God of the universe, but the God, my imaginary best friend God, becomes that one that I seek to be committed to emotionally and have my needs met, at least pretend to have my needs met through that relationship. I remember I was counseling once. Well, I wasn't really counseling. This guy came in to chew me out after my sermon. we called it counseling. The first thing he said, he came into the office and he sat down and he said, how did he put it? I spent time with my lover this morning, and then went on to explain to me how important it was for him to spend time with God and enjoy his love relationship with God before he said hi to his wife or had anything to do with his wife. And that just struck me as bizarre, frankly. I mean, I just thought that was really strange. In a certain way, it sounds pious. You know, it has a certain superficial appeal for a lot of us as Christians, because how can loving God be wrong, you know? And yeah, God needs to be my lover or something like that. But I think that's fallacious. I think it's a completely wrong way of understanding who God is and what he wants from us and what God is all about. God wants me to incarnate my love for him by demonstrating that in my commitment to other people. That's how I love God. That's what he said. If you love me, you'll keep my commandments, is what he said. You won't sit there and tell people how much I'm your lover. You'll do something in action, in loving, kind, compassionate obedience to God. So, yeah, that's a good point. I think that's possible.
I think one of the hardest things I had to come to grips with in becoming persuaded by the idea of emotional fornication is this sense of the thing that you were talking about, that love is good. You know, why would we resist love? You know, if you feel love, go for it. And it sort of in the middle of thinking about that, I think I was intellectually persuaded before I was emotionally persuaded, before it entirely made sense to me. And I would argue your case to other people and who were not persuaded. And maybe if you'd been doing the arguing, they would have been. But they would say, but, you know, but I love this person. And one of the things that struck me, and occasionally I had the fortitude to actually say that, is say, well, what does that mean? And if you love the person, why don't you commit to them? I mean, isn't that what love is? And if you won't commit to them, then what does that say about your claim to love them? And this was the connection between love and commitment, that would start to confuse them, because they recognized that what they were saying was by, I love this person, as opposed to my best friend. And trying to come to some kind of metaphor, some kind of image to illustrate that, one day, it just kind of happened. I was walking along the street, and this little kitten ran out of the yard that I was walking by, and it was really cute, and it was mewing and rubbing around my ankles and everything, so I started petting it, and it was purring, and I picked it up and cuddled it, and then I had to go. So I set it down, and it walked a few feet, and the kitten ran after me, so I picked it up, and I cuddled it some more, and it purred some more, and I petted it some more, and then I put it down and walked a few more feet, and it ran after me again. And all of a sudden I realized that I liked cuddling this kitten. I liked the fact that this kitten was just besotted with me. But I was encouraging it to follow me, and I had no intention of taking it home and taking care of it for the rest of its natural life. And if we kept doing this little thing, it's going to get far enough away from its yard, it's not going to be able to find its way back. And it's going to, by my behavior, I was like displaying commitment behavior to this kitten. And I felt like, well, the kitten wants to be petted, right? It's happy when I pet it, it purrs. You know, isn't I'm giving the kitten what it wants. Isn't this loving behavior? But when it comes down to it, it was not loving behavior because I was encouraging it to stray from its house and it wouldn't be able to find its way back. So when it comes down to it, it's really desperately this kind of love that will not commit, but yet, you know, wants to write reams of poetry and wants to send flowers and gets fiercely jealous when the beloved, you know, looks at somebody else and yet will not commit. It's just desperately selfish. I like this, the fact that this kitten is besotted with me. I don't really want to think about what's best for the kitten because it feels so good to be able to cuddle the kitten and feel this little furry body purring against me. And I don't want to think about the fact that it's going to get lost and probably run out in the street and get run over, specifically because I acted so loving toward it.
Yeah. That's what I like about rock and roll. It can be really, really honest. I mean, even 50s rock and roll. I love you. I want you. I need you.
Yes. Or how about that Joni Mitchell song, My Old Man? We don't need a piece of paper from the city keeping us tried and true. Well, I am fairly certain she could probably have a hard time recalling the name of that old man that she didn't need the piece of paper from the city keeping her tried and true.
Right.
I think it was Graham Nash.
Oh, was it? Oh, okay. Well, I have two questions.
I kept track. She did.
Okay. Two questions from something you said, Jack. One, you said that the object of marriage is that I and my spouse have the same view of the world. And I thought, I was wondering...
We see the
world the same way.
Well, no, that I need to try to understand how she sees the world. We can still disagree, but I think I'm committed to getting to know her.
Okay.
And respecting what she...
Okay.
How she experiences it, how she sees it.
And then my second question was, when you were saying that the spouse has a right to demand exclusivity, there are some people who are so incredibly jealous. They say, look, I'm supposed to be the only one fulfilling your needs, so I'm going to cut you off from all your friends. I don't want you spending time with your friends. I don't want you sharing things with your friends that you don't share with me. You know, if you like to go hiking and I don't like to go hiking, I don't want you hiking with anybody else because you want somebody to hike with. You're just going to damn well not do any hiking. So I was just wondering if you could talk about the difference between an appropriate expectation of uniqueness and this kind of, I'm going to put you in a little prison and keep you there because I can.
I'll let them explain why, but that's sick.
Ditto. Yeah.
Well,
exclusivity, I think, in the commitment of marriage, what you're contracting for is this lifelong specialness and getting to know this person. Possession is not the same thing as exclusivity. And I think that that's a really important distinction.
I think what you
control
just described...
behavior.
I'm sorry. I think what you just described earlier, that's just the counterpart of that in marriage, where you are there to meet my needs, and I want to keep you as a meter of my needs, and that's all I'm going to allow you to do is meet my needs. And yeah, it's just pathologically selfish. That's just really sick.
There was something about your kitten analogy, to go back to that. What was wrong was, that's not your cat.
And I had no intention
right?
of making it my cat.
No, it's not your own. And then that sort of a light went on in terms of the language of calling a spouse my own, in that sense of the owner of that cat, where you do what's in the cat's best interest, you care about the cat, so on and so forth, where you cherish that. But I would say the person that is exclusive in the sense of authoritarian is violated the right at some level to, in a sense, they're violating their contract. I mean, just like a person that abuses an animal doesn't deserve to have animals. They've foregone their commitment.
A couple things. I'm going to borrow something which I remember Tucker saying many years ago, when he said that it's not uncommon, or it's actually fairly common, to hear the death knell of a relationship by saying, "I just want to be friends." And you hear that a lot in movies or on TV or someplace like that, when two people have been dating, and "I just want to be friends" signals the end of this relationship. And whether it's on a beer commercial or it's on, you know, some heartstrings, tugging at the heartstrings movie, it seems to be the pinnacle of some part of the film or a show or whatever you're seeing. And I think that's kind of interesting. Now, for the other thing, Nancy, you talked a lot about needs. Now, are you lumping in, or are you differentiating between wants and desires when you're saying needs, or are you including all of those in one, or how is that being used?
I'm not sure that we experience them as separate. I suppose I could say, I mean,
because you can realize that you have a need, and then a want can develop from that, or a desire can develop from that, all from the same mm-hmm. focal point. And it can grow, or I hate to say grow, but it can become something else, all the while it's still a need.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so.
So you're saying that desires, wants and desires are extensions of our needs?
That's kind of how I look at it
mm-hmm.
right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see necessarily wants and desires as being one and the same thing with, or synonymous with needs itself. I think that you can recognize that you need something, but you can, it seems like you can also say, it can also be taken too far, mm-hmm. where it goes from a need to something else. Say, like, I need to go to school, but I'm just too darn sick to go to school. I'm too sick, I can't get out of bed. So you have the desire to go to school, but and you have a need, but those are two different things. You see what I'm saying?
I'm trying.
Yeah. The school analogy is not
true
the best.
Need,
I don't think
right, the true need might be to
that.
Stay home and stay in bed if I'm sick. Yeah, sometimes I think that we
okay.
use those words in a way that
interchangeably
gives, well, not necessarily, that maybe makes it less threatening. In other words, I can talk about something I have a desire for, a want for, and it's not quite as vulnerable as saying I have a need. In other words, I can see myself as more in charge of it, perhaps, than if I call it a need. If I end up having to call it a need, then I'm kind of having to be uncomfortable with that or something. I don't know. I haven't really thought about the distinction. This is off the top.
You were talking about that in the context of deprivation. So, I mean, mm-hmm. you could almost mm-hmm. define, I think you could define it in those terms as a yeah. need is something that if it's not fulfilled, there is some sort of deprivation that you're experiencing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It seems like there's, I mean, Adam had a need. I mean, there was a certain, and we all to some degree have that longing for companionship, to be known, to have an intimate, lifelong committed relationship in marriage. I mean, that's, and I guess the only analogy that comes to mind is there's that need. It's sort of a basic part of the blood that flows through our veins.
We're wired.
And then, yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then there's the high octane need. It's like there's a certain neediness born out of I will not survive, mm-hmm. and that's where I think we cross over into trying to get needs that perhaps weren't met mm-hmm. through this relationship, through this. Please make me feel important. Please make me feel seen. Please care about me. And that's where it crosses over into sexuality a lot, too, is mm-hmm. we can fuse sexuality with having certain needs met. So that's, it goes sort of into hyper
I think
needs.
That's a really good way to put it, a high octane need, that it's kind of like when Larry talks about triangles. If if I'm out here on an 8 on a scale of 1 to 10 in my need level, where the real need is maybe a 4, and that's legitimate real need, well then the 4 to the 8 might say more about what my particular experience has brought to me, or a need I haven't had met that was a legitimate need.
I remember a weird little mind battle that I had to go through along those lines. I had a very difficult time allowing myself to simply look at what I wanted and acknowledge what I wanted and letting go of it, because what my mind told me is, well, if you let go of it and you stop wanting it, God won't give it to you. So you have to want it bad so that God knows you want it bad so that he'll give it to you. And it actually had the a negative effect, because it makes you kick it into the high octane mode that you're talking about, rather than just allow it to be the underlying reality of your life and just leave it there. You feed the desire and you feed the want and you feed the need, because you want God to see you miserable so that he can reach out and have mercy on your misery.
Or conversely, I know for myself, in my early years, there was some Christian teaching that led me to think, if I just don't need it, then God will give it to me. Because, you know, you'd hear these stories from married people that would talk about, well, it happened when I quit looking. Oh, okay.
It's the formula.
The formula.
I'm not looking. I'm not looking.
Right. I don't care.
Which is just all about self-deception when you come right down to it. But anyway, did we even get close to what your question was?
I stopped looking. No, kind of. I was... I think Andrew kind of touched on it there when it kicks into this need that we have that hasn't been met, or that we want met, and it hasn't been, and then we kick it into this higher octane mode, and it goes, you know, a need, and then it moves further to where we actually try and pursue it more actively, or possibly, yeah, kind of. Andrew was going on pretty good there for a moment.
Wait, what'd you say?
Maybe blinders or something like that. It seems like we all recognize that we have the need, but when it becomes a want or a desire, for me at least, that's where I see that it's not just an acknowledgement of that, but it's something else, or I'm treating it differently.
Does it become a demand?
It could.
I think demand and need are good distinctions to make, too, because I can have needs, but how I respond to those needs, I can either respond by accepting that I might face a deprivation, or I can respond by demanding. Right. And I can demand it from God, and I can demand it from the person that's closest to me as well.
This question goes back a little bit ago, and I think you might have asked about what is a realistic expectation in a marriage of, you know, if the person should be hanging out with their friends or whatnot. It's something along those lines. Anyway, this has to do with a friend of mine back home is getting married soon, and it's like a disaster waiting to happen. I mean, everybody has the red flags. He even has red flags. Like, I mean, everybody's telling him, and it's just not a good situation. He is just going down that aisle. It's like the aisle of doom, and he's walking down that aisle. Well, the only reason why he's ever been able to hang out with his old friends at all, I guess, in the last few months is because she's been out of town.
Oh.
But I don't know. It's kind of, I mean, is, I guess, I'm trying to figure out how my question would apply to emotional fornication. Like, I mean, Does she have that? That, I mean, if you were in my shoes, would you say something to him? I mean, can she accuse him of emotional fornication if he goes and hangs out with his friends and she doesn't have control over him for a few minutes?
Well,
I could make this more dramatic, but I'll tone it down.
I think you do need to keep in mind that engagement is the hardest time of a person's life. For some of us.
Well, it was like this before engagement.
But I mean, it, like you say, there may be some real. I don't know. I mean, all I have is your description. You're telling me that it's disaster. But all I'm saying is that I would want to look at it with a little bit of grace. In that, before the commitment is an incredibly insecure time. And people deal with that insecurity differently. What I would be concerned about is if it's not out of the insecurity that she's acting that way, but out of some kind of, you know, permanent lifestyle and permanent resolve, then there's some problems there.
I think
but you'd want to untangle how much of this is her insecurity showing, and she can relax when the deal is done, it's signed on the bottom line, he's given his life to her for keeps. Some women experience a great deal of relief when that happens, and they change.
I guess one instance that really caught me off guard in that situation was when it was one of our birthdays or something, and we were going to go out and have, like, you know, I don't know, chicken wings or something. And she said, I was clarifying, so you didn't think we're going to go out drinking. Hard liquor. Whatever. Okay, so she said she didn't want him to go, and he's like, you know, it's so and so's birthday. We're just gonna go out and do this. And she goes, well, what am I gonna do while you're out doing that? You know, I don't have anybody. And I don't know if that's like. I mean, I guess the issue just got down to. So is he. Is he like her only, you know, is like he her only life or something? Or is she depending on him for her identity or her emotional well-being or, you know, and I mean, because that sounds like to me, like that could be some, in a way, kind of an emotional, not good, whatever it is. Do you see what I'm saying, though?
Yeah. Well, you're certainly right that there is something that can happen in marriage where it's not, again, it's about getting my needs met rather than what I think marriage is really all about, and that is learning to be the right kind of partner to my wife or husband. And what we need to know is that that's self-defeating. I mean, there's nothing will suffocate a person more than making them my salvation. Most of us are not up to the task of being somebody's savior, and it can really be suffocating. So, yeah, I mean, from what you've described, that could be a very difficult time.
The question will be how she responds when she realizes he can't save her.
Right.
And that will be really telling. And that could be, you could be sitting here 10 years from now saying that they have an incredible marriage because of how they respond to that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no one goes into marriage.
Yeah, the issue is her character, Tommy, not her emotional needs right now. Because we can grow. You know, we can learn. We can adjust. We can learn who God is and what life is all about and what reality is all about and come to terms with that if we have the character.
Yeah.
If that's the resolve of our life.
It was sort of just before I moved here, it got kind of complicated because her aunt came to me and told me to warn him. And I didn't know, I guess she was her landlord for a while, you know, and I didn't know, and I was like, you know, why am I going to warn this guy, you know, I don't have any problem with it, and I started paying attention after that, and then I moved away, it was too late, but I don't know, I think that it was a character issue, but I don't really know, and I don't feel comfortable, like, you know, venturing into that, analyzing this whole thing, but the input that you guys gave was very good. I mean, it made sense, so. And it's on tape. Says Heather.
You may talk about this later, I don't know, but just in talking about, like, before marriage, like, I see emotional fornication before marriage, I mean, after marriage, somewhat more as a more definite thing, but, like, before marriage, where is that line? Because a lot of times, like, when you're dating, you are having this, like, pseudo-committed relationship where you're not just friends and not just, like, hanging out with everyone, but you're kind of more exclusive, but you're not really married exclusive, and so it's like this pseudo-confusing, weird time. And so how would you keep yourself from committing emotional adultery in a relationship like that when you're trying to get to know someone really well and you're trying to be more exclusive with them and be more committed to them than you would just any other person?
Stay tuned. That's actually next week's topic. We're going to talk about
our whole topic.
Yeah, we're going to talk about dating and friendship and the transition. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's totally okay. Fine. I just have one other question. Like,
I think that's a really good question. Can I just say that? And I think you're like picking up on a really big implication of what we're saying that we're going to expand on next time.
Yeah, it's just something I've been thinking a lot about. And the other thing that I have a question about is, can you have, like, you said something about, like, you said something about homosexuality at the beginning, and I was just wondering, like, if you consider, like, emotional adultery as something that can happen between people of the same sex when they're just friends. I mean, like, there's no, like, erotic feelings there or something, but just a friendship.
I think it can, yes. I had somebody come to me in college once. It was the weirdest experience of my life. He sat me down to rebuke me as a brother needs to rebuke a brother. And his rebuke basically was, you're not married to me. I mean, he didn't use that But as he spelled out what he expected from me and what he wanted from me and what it would mean if I was really loving him as Jesus would have me love him, he wanted me to be married to him. And I just didn't think that was appropriate. For a number of reasons. So I do. I think people can shift their emotional needs to somebody of the same sex and expect this need to be met emotionally, not physically, not sexually, not erotically, but emotionally to be met by somebody of the same sex. And I think it's equally inappropriate in a same-sex relationship as it is in a heterosexual relationship.
Okay.
Because it's not friendship. It's something else. It's different.
Okay, well, I think that clarifies your definition of emotional adultery then a little bit more, just in that it's like expecting, it's having this need for someone else that's inappropriate. I mean, is that more...
Right, right. But it's inappropriate because of the exclusivity of it, because of the level and nature of the intimacy of it, because of the nature of the mutual dependence. Those are the characteristics of the inappropriateness of it. They would be appropriate in marriage. In marriage, they're very appropriate. But outside of marriage, they're not appropriate aspects of our relationship.
Just a quick comment. As you're married and you go on in those years of marriage and you're maturing and even as you're growing, it makes a lot of sense to choose friends, to watch out who your friends are, and to choose friends who will support your relationship with your wife. I've been meeting with men for a lot of years, and it's all around supporting our wives, supporting our relationships. And that's a real key piece because you also become open to them so that they can correct you. And the more transparent you are about all that and the sin in your life, you see sin growing. You don't see sin, you're holding it down. You see it grow because now you see the finer points of sin, and so you need more and more protection. You need to save your wife for yourself. So many pieces of that, if that means turning your head when you see a beautiful woman walk down the street, or whatever it is, so that you save your thought life, your eyes, for your wife.
Okay, I've been told, mostly by my mom for a long time, that having a relationship, a friendship with a boy, if you get emotionally attached or you get really deep in the relationship, then there'll probably be a lot of problems and you'll have to go back to, as Jonah was talking about, the we're just friends thing. So my question is, I've always assumed that since I don't want to be in a relationship where it gets too deep with a boy until I'm ready to get married or start dating or whatever, that I can have that relationship with my female friends. So is that committing emotional fornication? And is there a way that you can have, I don't know if it would be needs met or what, but relationships with friends, there's this give and take thing where things go deeper and you talk things through. How do you avoid emotional fornication or homosexuality in that situation?
You want to try something?
Well, I thought I had an idea. I guess what I'm thinking as I'm listening to you is that I think there are real legitimate needs that are met in friendship. So on the one hand, absolutely, I think that's a really appropriate way to go. I think that even as we, like Jim was just sharing, even as we age and are married, our friendships support us in a lot of ways. And in contrast to the gentleman Margaret referred to that has possession in mind, there's so much richness that can come from a circle of people in my life. But the shift is what we're talking about with the exclusivity and the expectation and those kinds of things. If that starts to become out of balance, then I think it becomes an issue. So if you are in friendships that you begin to, and in some ways maybe like remember junior high or middle school where you're my best friend and you can't be her best friend. You know, there's like jealousy and those kinds of things. It's just not appropriate in a real friendship that that we look at it that way. I mean, friendship has a different level, a different kind of commitment to it than marriage. And I guess that's kind of where I would go with that.
Yeah, exactly. Remember that it seems to me that one of the marks of friendship is that if as life goes on and life experience changes me and changes my circumstances and I drift apart from a friend, I haven't betrayed them and they haven't betrayed me. It's just the dynamics of life and experience. But a committed relationship, which marriage is, none of that stuff should drive us apart. There's no such thing as drifting apart if I'm paying attention to and tending to my marriage. So it comes down to what Nancy's saying, the expectations, the rights, the responsibilities, the duties to one another, the exclusivity, the level of the commitment, and so on. There is a way that I can decide to play up marriage instead of having a friendship. And that those are qualitatively different things. I don't think marriage is just on a spectrum, you know, this good of a friend. They're not even on the same spectrum. It's a qualitatively different kind of relationship with a different logic to it from friendship. Jonathan has been trying to get the mic for him. Okay.
This is just a quick question for definition's sake. Is it necessary for emotional fornication that there be two people involved? And the scenario I think of is, say you have a husband and wife, and the husband has a hobby such as building trains or something, and in building the trains, he, because the human mind can do this, sort of crafts another persona, and this is a persona that he finds needs fulfilled in, he finds satisfaction in, and that robs his or her spouse of themselves. And it could be any idea or any passion or anything like that. So is that something different, or is it a type of emotional fornication?
Well, in my terminology, it's something different. It's equally problematic. But you could expand the definition of it to include that if you wanted to use the word that way.
They're not.
But they're not. I don't think they're quite the same thing unless... unless you can turn your hop. I mean, you hear all those stories about sailors who are married to the sea. So maybe there's this weird thing that the male mind can do. I don't know. But I have in mind it being a somewhat different phenomenon.
And yet it's born, I think, of the same spirit.
Same spirit, exactly. Yeah.
If not this person's going to fulfill me, then this thing, this hobby, is going to fulfill me, and it's the same inability to sit quiet, like Nancy said, with not having certain needs met.
The reason I'm reserving the term where there is likely to be an infatuation that's a part of the experience, and that's why I see it as with another person. But
hey, I want to compliment you. I think this is wonderful, like really absolutely wonderful. And it's going to be somewhat rhetorical because I'm just not quite sure it has anything to do with Christianity. Like, and part of, so what I want at some level, just because I'm going to assume that it does, I was just wondering how you're, if you could ground this in scripture for me. And I know, I think it's somewhat important. I mean, it's kind of built off of, you valorize marriage. Like, marriage is the primary context in which you come to know God. And then you did that off of the Genesis, in Genesis, when it talks about the two should become one flesh. I'm just not quite sure we can use that.
I'm not quite sure, sorry.
Not quite sure we can use that. I mean, in Ephesians, it also uses the same passage, which I'm sure you're aware of. But it starts off where Christ is the head of the church. And then the love that Christ has for us, and that this love should come to full knowledge among us, in one among us, this knowledge among us. And he goes on to talk about the practices of the church and the loving one another, being slaves. I mean, just this dramatic language of love going on one unto another. And then after that, only after that, does he talk about marriage before he talks about slaves. I mean, it's just, and the occurrence of love with marriage is just almost, I mean, it happens very little in comparison of the love that is talked about happening in the church. Now, what I think you're saying has some valid points. Like, I think you all are saying some good stuff. I just wonder if it doesn't happen with the practice of confession and discernment and forgiveness and truth-telling as practices in the church. If it isn't happening in that context, it's just going to breed suspicion.
If what isn't happening in that context?
If some of the things that you're talking about self-control, considering other, this idea of emotional fornication, I think there's some truth in some of that. I just think if it's not happening in the context of the church in its practices of confession and truth-telling and forgiveness and discernment in the body, it's just going to breed what our culture already has. The reason why we're so neurotic about falling in love with people is because we're so isolated and alone. I mean, this idea of I just fear that what you're saying, the truth of what you're saying, will be lost on the suspicion and just totally anti-Christian consequence isolation. Thanks.
Are you saying that that you have a concern that what we're recommending is isolation?
Well, I mean, partly it comes, I would say, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I could explain that a little.
I think I follow what you're saying, and I think it's a really good point, because I I think what we're actually saying is that how we are responsible, I think you could ground it in the scriptures about just what it looks like to love, and that being the second commandment, to love each other. But practically speaking, being responsible with who we are and what we need and how we go about getting that, I think is really essential. And I think the way that can happen the best is if, in being responsible, we are owning our own sense of need, and getting the ones we can get met appropriately in the context of friendship, marriage, and account. And the word accountability strikes fear into my heart because of the context and the way it's been used a lot. But what I mean by that is a kind of a genuine sense, like what Jim was referring to, where you have a circle of people who you can be so honest with that they help you see you, and they help you see what you might have trouble seeing. The thing is that we all have trouble seeing ourselves, and we all self-justify, and we all make up reasons why what we're doing is right and not wrong. And so to be openly transparent with people who we trust and who care about us, I think is critical to growing in wisdom and to learning how to love.
I mean, microphone.